Hi there, you're listening to the LLB podcast, the podcast for law students and young lawyers. My name is Johnny Nguyen and I'll be your host today. Welcome to episode 14 of the podcast. This one is a must listen to if you're working in a government policy position currently or you want to get into one of those jobs. Today we're deep diving into what good government policy looks like. Our guest speaker is Jason Lange, and he works in a role where he and his team are responsible for the quality assurance of the Australian government's federal policies. And this gives him a really broad and deep experience to talk to us about in terms of what good policies need and look like. I hope you enjoy today's episode. I've got Jason Lange with me here today, and Jason is the Executive Director of the Office of Best Practice Regulation. This office sits within the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet in Australia. And today we're going to be discussing the work of the OBPR, the Office of Best Practice Regulation. To start us off here, can you tell us what your journey's been like getting to your position now?
Thanks, Johnny. Thanks for having me and thanks for the listeners for tuning in. So I've worked for about 17 years, coming up to 18 years in the Australian Public Service and Victorian Public Service, that's one of our states here. And it was a bit of a surprise journey into the public service. I think there's several graduates, a fair chunk of graduates that want to dedicate their lives to the public service. I'm not sure I was in that cohort when I fell into a role in 2004, but from day one, I was hooked in terms of the position of the public service being able to improve the lives of Australians and contribute to some pretty interesting policies over time. So that journey took me from where I started through where I am today, covering about six departments.
Yeah, wow. Okay, well, the question I always want to ask, since you've worked at both that national and state level, is there any interesting difference or similarity that should be noted in terms of working from different levels of government?
Yeah, I think on paper, you think they're very similar. One of the things that really stood out for me at the state level was the overwhelming desire to do it themselves, to do it with their budget, do it with their policies, not to interact with the Commonwealth. Very palpable from day one. And, of course, the state budget is relatively finite. I mean, the Commonwealth budget's finite as well, but it's just dramatically bigger. That was one of the big things I took out of the 4 years I spent there was this focus on really doing it ourselves.
And so what were you doing at the state level exactly?
Yeah, so part of the time there was at the Department of Planning and Cabinet in industry policy, and a big chunk of time was in the industry department, looking after one of the component parts was a review of economic development at the state level, and another part was an economic inclusion, sort of like a labour market, sort of social inclusion policy role. So all of it was in labour market or employment policy or industry policy in the state. I'd say that the states are very good at, because it might be a relative concept, but very good at trains running on time, getting the police on the beat, a lot of those operational things which I would not have a clue on how to do and would be terrible in those roles. But I guess on industry policy, it was very much a grants mentality. We run a grants round. We offer more grants. If something's going wrong, we just increase the size of the grants.
Sure.
And a really big takeaway message for me was there's only so much a state government can do with a whole heap of the policy levers that are within their control. And a lot of the issues that I worked on or content I worked on was really not for the state to solve.
Right.
That really was clear to me after the 4 years there, was that it was really the Commonwealth that had a lot of those settings, which needs to work in partnership with the states. But if a state was not that keen on engaging with the Commonwealth, the two were potentially at opposing ends of the spectrum. Particularly with grants programs as well, they're just really designed for a particular purpose, but they don't solve the underlying problem. And so that was quite an interesting experience, thinking of grants as a mechanism to connect with and give support to industry. But the grants and the contracts themselves, if they don't require much change, nothing really. You never get to the end of the grants process unless we have more grants, if you like. And so that was quite an insight. Also at the state level, you're just so much more connected with the firms. This is the firm from Geelong. They are in trouble. What can you do? Premier's office. It's just very, very local, and concepts, theoretical concepts of, a firm should just change its focus or improve its factory or increase its R&D. That's all well and good to have in your brain and in your mind, but sitting across the table from companies, that's sort of the main topic of conversation you have with them, because you're just right there next to them. You see the head of government or senior executives, and when they're engaging with stakeholders, they don't come at it from a why don't you just increase your effectiveness. Whereas in Canberra, that might be our first response, I guess. So it's very applied policy at the local level. And there's a lot of pressure on what can we give them today? What can we do today for them? As opposed to looking at structural longer term challenges.
But it sounds like your work at the state level was very much on the ground and applied. So looking then at your experience at the federal level, let's get to the bread and butter of the OBPR. What exactly does the OBPR do?
So sometimes I describe the role as the homework police, which may not be quite right, but in terms of those listening to this, perhaps maybe that's one way to describe it to non-public servants. So any major decision of government that's coming forward, we look at it and think, well, if this would have a major field effect on business or individuals and how they change, go about their lives, or if it changes their lives or how they operate their business, it's in our scope to determine if that triggers our involvement. So roughly about 70 to 80 times a year, we say this upcoming policy proposal is going to be so significant on business and individuals or the community that it requires an additional level of analysis, an additional level of QA by a neutral third party other than the proposing ministry or department, and our office gets involved. So we first and foremost are a coach with the agency to support them on building the evidence base and looking at the impact analysis, and I suspect we'll go through that in a minute, but also we're an assessor of their work. So ultimately, we shift from being a coach to saying, is this work good enough? Does it meet the government's requirements for what the government expects to see? Analysis and advice from the bureaucracy to support some big major decisions they're about to take.
Sure. So it sounds like it's not too different for university students listening to their tutors and their lecturers, right? Like, they teach you the content, but they're also usually the ones that then mark your FAQ exams, etc.
Yeah, that's right. I guess people listening from the outside might think, well, you're a bureaucrat, working with other bureaucrats to look at the analysis, but OBPR really takes its independence quite strongly from the rest of the bureaucracy. I mean, we are a branch and a function that sits within the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet, but we really have quite a defined role, a defined set of rules, if you like, frameworks or rules that we administer, which is this lovely book here, which I'm sure Johnny can have on the link. But this is basically our requirements that when we work with another department, this is what they have to meet to get the new and pass mark past us.
Sure. So coming from the outside looking in here, how does OBPR potentially add value to a specialist agency when it itself might not be a specialist in that area? If a Department of Health has a health policy, how does the OBPR add value?
Yeah, I think first and foremost, we freely acknowledge that we're not the content experts. If there's dramatic changes that are happening to making something a prescribed good, perhaps nicotine-containing e-cigarettes, for example, the TGA, the health portfolio, are the professional experts. I'm not quite sure what goes in. 6 months ago, I wasn't quite sure what went in an e-cigarette. Now I've got a lot more about it than perhaps I'd like. But they are the content experts. Think of it as this way. What we do is we work with that agency to say, well, what do you think are the effects on any number of aspects of that? So what's the effect on competition if we were to ban a certain product? What's the effect on the price of goods or services, or the entrance of new businesses, or businesses exiting potentially? What are the distributional effects at play here? Does it affect men and women the same? Does it affect regional and rural businesses?
Can you explain what distributional effects are here?
Yeah. So if, as a direct result of that government decision, what are the effects on different cohorts? So small and medium and large businesses, does it affect them in the same way? Does it affect men and women in the same way? Does it affect people located in regional, or businesses located in regional settings as opposed to urban? So what's the distribution of that effect across the nation and by different cohort groups?
Mm.
You know, we might look at environmental effects, like what effect does this decision have on soil or air or water quality? There's two or three other types of effects as well. And so as a direct result of this decision about to be taken, how does it affect Australia?
Mm.
And not just in a fiscal sense for that department, you know, they might need tens of millions of dollars to actually administer it. But what's the effect? Can we quantify it, or at least qualitatively and in great detail describe the effect on business and individuals? Second and third round effects as well. Not just those immediately affected. And this is often where agencies will think of it as, if I ban this particular product or regulate this particular product, the firms that make it or buy it, this is how they're affected. But we come in and say, well, what are the second and third round effects? How does it then flow onto other people and other users beyond the immediately affected? That's an impact. That has an impact on people's lives. And often, in our experience, often a department will think about the impacts on their immediate stakeholders and their immediate first round effects, if you like. And what we do is we come in and build the evidence base to show whole of economy and whole of government effects. Because, of course, if that department or that regulator wants to make that change, they think about what's in their act or who their stakeholders are as their lens of impact. But when that proposal comes to cabinet, when it comes to the PM for agreement, when it comes to budget for consideration, we want, and government expects that we think about the effect on the nation as a whole.
Yeah.
And so what are the other effects that that department or regulator doesn't necessarily see? They're probably quite well at spotting that they're around, but how do you put facts and figures or descriptions to it when they're impacting sectors or stakeholders outside of their direct vision?
Yeah. Okay.
And so we look at that whole of government picture.
Yeah, so it sounds like there's a bit of scope here for OBPR to give that higher level perspective that our specialist agencies might not get because they're so close to that industry. Do you have a hypothetical practical example of, I suppose, the second round, third round impact, or the wider impact of a hypothetical proposal that might happen? Just because I'm aware, well, we can't talk about things that are on the wall.
Yeah, so say there's a particular financial product which the financial regulator thought might be causing harm to users. So something that might be quasi-gambling in nature, for instance. And if that regulator was to say, right, we're just going to ban that product. Some of the first questions you'd ask is, well, how many people use it? And what utility do they get out of having the product? Maybe they know that there's a good chance they make a loss on it. Well, yes, but do they know there's somewhat of a chance they make a win on it? Do they know that going in? Are they fully aware of those risks? Were they giving the shiny iPad by an unscrupulous provider as a way to sign them into this particular financial incentive, this particular financial product? Were they duped into it, in which case clearly, that's a risk to the consumers? Or were they fully aware of the risks and decided to do it anyway because they enjoyed the thrill of being on a commodity? So they're things which we test, which is really understanding the evidence base. And regulators in Australia are very, very professional, very good at what they do. But by definition, a regulator sees a risk and it looks to minimise the risk. So the risk in that hypothetical example is potential consumer harm. Now, the purpose of regulation, the OBPR's role, is not to ensure that every risk is reduced to zero. but it's understanding, well, what is the presence of that risk or that hazard or that issue in the community, and where's the evidence base behind it to justify the imposition of regulation? Now, it may well be blatantly obvious to everybody that that's something that we should shut down and ban. That's fine. But what we come in is we give a flat, neutral, independent assessment of if that risk, if there is a risk there, what's its prevalence? And what are the impacts of it? What's the status quo? If we did nothing, how is it hurting individuals or businesses or benefiting? And if we want to move away from the status quo, what's a range of valid and defensible options that should be considered? And what are the impacts of those? So that government is given, you know, the best possible analysis of what the problem is and what the fix, what the solutions are.
Sure. It sounds like so far, some of the things that you've mentioned that OBPR help agencies with are identifying different options to solve potential problems and checking the underlying assumptions that lie behind their thinking. Can you run me through, I guess, a high-level overview of the framework that OBPR uses and, again, the areas where agencies get a lot of value from OBPR?
Yeah, so there's many policy analysis frameworks out there in the world. We have one that we like and think it's pretty good, but there's many other competing frameworks out there. I guess the difference, of course, is that this is the one the Australian government has asked the Australian Public Service to look at and adhere to. So this is the one that we operate. But really, they're all pretty similar, and it's a policy analysis framework. I mean, it's described as the regulatory impact analysis framework, but really it's policy one-on-one. So
yeah,
you know, starting with what's the problem. You know, that sounds very simple to many listeners, but you know, I challenge you to write in a sentence exactly what the problem is without pages and pages of context and background. So it's a really, really narrowing precisely what is it that's the problem. And that's not the symptom. That's not the problem that the minister wants to create in order to act upon it. It's not the problem easiest for the agency to fix. It's not the part of the problem that's simplest for the agency to fix. It's what is the problem, the underlying cause of the issue you're trying to fix. And then the very next question is, well, why does government need to be involved? You would be amazed as to how many new policy proposals and work across the Commonwealth fall down at that step. Why is government needing to fix this? Why is it not a market or an individual's responsibility? Why does Commonwealth government need to fix this? And you go through the rest of the framework. So it's, well, what are the options that are available? Again, not just the options easiest for the regulator. What's the best whole of government option here? Those options may sit in another department. You know, a department may be bringing forward a change, but the best option may be a revenue option for a taxation, or it might be banning something at the border, for instance, that completely falls outside that capacity of that department that rests with another department. So what's the best few options that could actually address it, not just their preferred favourite, but also several other options as well, to show a full range has been considered. And then stepping through to which one has the highest net benefit. What are the pros and cons and the impacts of each analysis, of each option, and how do you get to a discussion around which one has the best benefit for the country? And critically, well, who have you spoken to and what have they said? Not just the stakeholders you've spoken to that like the idea, all the stakeholders involved, and if you haven't spoken to them, what would we expect them to say? So it's not plausible or feasible to consult every person in Australia on every major policy change. But what this framework does is it forces the department proposing the change to think through, well, here are what stakeholders are known to have said, or here's how they would likely react if they were presented with those options. So that decision makers see the full picture on what their views and reactions would be, not just, like I said, the group of stakeholders that are most invested in the action change.
Yeah.
And impact and evaluation is a really, really important aspect of this as well. So how will you actually deliver this particular change and how will you evaluate it? But really the key question is, which option do you recommend? Which option has the highest net benefit to Australia? Given all the above, given all the department's expert technical knowledge and the analysis that's been done and agreed with my office, how do you pick the option that's got the best, highest net benefit for Australia? So that's the framework we use. It's in that guide that I held up at the start. And that's really, it's a pretty sensible, in my view. Of course, I'd say this, but it's a pretty sensible.
Completely unbiased,
but I think it's fantastic. It's a way to think about and frame really complex policy problems and step through, well, how am I actually going to fix it?
Yeah.
And putting it, and then the discipline of putting that on paper. Now, of course, some listeners may not know that every time this is done, where a government makes a decision, this document is released. It's publicly available on PNEC's website. It's called a Regulation Impact Statement, the noun, the actual document, and that's released alongside OBPR's assessment of the quality of that work and the processes involved. So these things are freely available on PNEC's website. We can put that link up as well. And so, you know, I might ask you, when you see government announcing a major change to something, there's a very high likelihood that you'll be able to find a RIS on PNEC's website that steps through all of those things and shows citizens of Australia that government and its departments have really thought through what the problem is and how to fix it and presented that advice to decision makers.
I thought the OBPR and the team here have two really important functions on two dimensions here. So that last bit there, I know that it sounds like that's a really great resource for both the public generally to know about what government is doing. But in terms of the listeners here, if you're interested in any sort of government department that's doing anything major, you can probably increase your chances of applying there successfully by just knowing how they go about their work. So looking at their risks, the things that they consider and how they analyze different stakeholders, different impacts, etc. But looking internally then, from what you've said, like from my experience being here in the team, it sounds like policy work is often just a minefield of potential blind spots. There's just things that are unintended that can happen, and that it's a complex arena of, you know, it's an intertwining of all these different factors, different stakeholders, different potential consequences. And it sounds like the OBPR really has expertise in getting through this process in a really robust and comprehensive way, a systematic way of analyzing and making sure that you don't potentially forget to consult a certain stakeholder or, you know, consider a particular impact. With that in mind, I'm thinking it's probably a good thing for young APF officers, especially anyone aspiring to be a public servant, to engage with the OBPR when they do their work. So, at that point then, what's the best way, how should APF officers go about engaging with the OBPR to get the most value?
Yeah, good question. So we have dedicated personnel for allocated to and for each portfolio of Australian government. So very first question would be a call through on a general number or email address and find out, you know, who looks after your portfolio. It might be Johnny looks after the environment, or Jane looks after home affairs, you know, whatnot. So we have a dedicated person. And, you know, really thinking about our role twofold. There's the, is a RIS needed? Is this impact analysis required for my decision? And you want to know that sooner rather than later so that you don't delay your processes of government through decision making and have OBPR critiquing through government. The quality of that work or proposal, we'd like to avoid that. But really, think of us as a very neutral third party, really. So Johnny and Jane, whoever it is here, can come over and say, well, what's the problem definition? And put us in a room with a whiteboard and talk through why the government needs to be involved, or show us what you think the impact analysis might be. And we'll say, well, hang on. You know, that's really, really good for A, B, and C effects, but what about this competition effect? Or, you know, what will this do to house prices if we change where we require university students to relocate to, you know, foreign university students? Or what will be the effect on the labour market if we make those changes to how Pacific labour schemes work? Now, it's almost like a free consultancy, if you like, to agencies out there. You know, we don't charge for our time. Obviously, everything's in confidence and not shared more broadly, et cetera, and held in strictest confidence. But when done early, that policy analysis framework, when done early, can really dramatically shift the design of a proposal, can identify those weak spots, identify those minefields, and give the agency time to actually think about it and address it.
Yeah.
Rather than when doing late in the process, where its usefulness is dramatically reduced. Now, agencies still need OBPR's tick of approval, to describe the quality analysis, etc. And I would have thought you'd want to get that done as soon as possible. But in realistic terms, starting with those questions when you tackle the problem, or what you think is the problem, actually helps you to say, well, actually, no, I do know this really in and out, and we don't need overpowers assistance, and that's absolutely fine. Or you might say, well, actually, there's an option here that will dramatically fix this issue, but it rests with Home Affairs. Who do I contact there? There's a revenue option. Maybe we should just tax all drones at 6,000%, and that way they won't fly into planes, rather than just banning them. Well, that's a treasury option. So who do I actually connect with? So we actually play a bit of a switchboard function in the Australian government to connect you with officers in portfolios that could help you develop an option that may well actually better address the problem you're dealing with than the options available to your department.
I think there's two things to note here that are pretty significant. So I think the first is just to sort of like contextualize it in a relatable way for people that might not work in government. I feel like a similar experience for me would be, say, the assignment and essay review function at university. If you submit it with like 10 minutes to go before you try to hand something in, no matter what the feedback is, you're probably not going to find it that useful. But if you engage them, you know, 2 weeks out from when you need to submit an essay and they give you substantive feedback, you're probably going to be able to implement a lot more of that than if you'd wait to the last second. But the second thing that comes to my mind, though, is that when you talk about, like, those options that are outside the existing department, so, you know, you could be engaging Treasury or Home Affairs or another department, it sounds like the OBPR plays a critical role in facilitating collaboration with the APA. So, again, making sure that you're not thinking within your own specialist shoes, but actually engaging all of government to get that whole government analysis, but also potentially all of government action as well. In looking at that, so let's zoom out a little bit here. So, if we look at the broader goal of the OBPR, what is the goal? What's the end game for administering the risk requirements, this impact analysis framework? What's the final outcome? What do we want to achieve?
Well, I guess in a sentence, it would be delivering the best possible analysis to government. Really, that's what it's about. Not just that one department's view, the best whole of government analysis and advice to the decision maker. The whole purpose of the impact analysis framework is to equip the decision maker with all the material they need to know to make a decision. It's not to bind them into the decision. They can go with whatever option they want or something that's not even a piece of paper. That's fine. The whole point of the impact analysis framework is to present them when they sit down to say, should we do X? They understand who will be affected, businesses or individuals, to what extent. What are the risks that are being tackled? What are the costs of inaction or not doing it? Which of the three or four options is best placed to address it, or to address it to the largest extent, or with the least amount of trade-offs, or with the trade-offs they're most happy with? Understanding what the views of citizens and businesses are of those different issues, and then saying, on balance, this is the option we want to do. Now, that's the whole purpose of bureaucracy in general. But that's the explicit purpose of this framework, is to present it in a written form, in the form of a RIS. And you know, there's a whole round of secondary benefits, like the transparency as well, when these are released, so that citizens can see the decision-making processes of government and the basis on which major decisions that affect them are made. There's big transparency benefits there as well. But really, it's about supporting the decision makers so they can make the decisions that we expect of them.
So that sounds good. And I guess coming from an outside perspective again, I think a lot of people would be curious at this point. Have you been able to observe, and can you tell us about times where you've observed improvements in the final outcomes of policy as a result of engaging in this framework?
Yeah, I guess for me, the challenge is picking an example that shouldn't be considered a critique of that department. So I'm going to be very bureaucratic and not give you an example. But you can imagine a proposal that, you know, let's give all school kids free blue socks, right? Because we're worried about them not having blue socks. Right? Make up the example. And you can imagine, you know, the scenario where the department says, yep, no problems, that's what the minister wants to do, let's run with it. And then, you know, we come in and say, well, but what's the problem? Well, the problem is kids don't have enough socks. Well, is it because the family doesn't have enough income? Is it they keep losing them? Is it the dog keeps eating them on the bed? Like, what's the actual problem here? And what are you actually going to do? It's like, well, actually, that's a good question. Like, we think the problem is such and such. And we say, well, but on what basis are we making that? That's an assumption. How do we test that? How do we prove that? It may well be that the dryer keeps eating the socks, and I think all washing dryers do. And you think, where do these socks go? But then it might be, well, why is it blue socks? Why not green socks? Why not yellow socks? Like, why have we locked in on that option to address it? And again, you know, drawing on the analysis and the advice of the department, they are experts in the procurement and production of socks. Right? Don't mean to be glib, but just as a hypothetical. But we come in and say, well, but why is that the case? And if it's actually going to be more expensive to go with blue socks, why don't we just say socks? Why pick a colour? Why pick a specifics? Is it footwear, you know, rather than socks? So really testing, I guess, the mindset of why we've locked in on that problem and that evidence behind it and that option specifically, and say, well, hang on, what exactly is it you're trying to fix here? Are there better options to actually solve it? And finding out through that iterative process with the department that actually it's not the socks that are the issue, it's that, you know, kids can't find the right footwear or whatnot. Being, you know, trying to give a really high-level example here, but that then leads itself to different options. Procurement of footwear is obviously different to giving kids free socks. Or maybe you don't give it to the kids, they keep losing it, give it to the parents. So the delivery of it, the model you choose to deliver it changes. And so actually spitballing that with OVPR, working that through with us to bring in that outside perspective, because the department's so close to it, they just want to, you know, run with that program, you know, see an issue and fix it. And we come in and say, well, just tell us again why we're doing it this way. You know, and it's done in a really constructive manner, but it's a critical friend, if you like, for us to sort of kick the tires on and say, actually, no, that's really sensible. We see how you found that. No problems, write that up into your analysis. That's really defensible. Or we come in and say, well, hang on, we can't see why we've landed on that conclusion or why we've landed on that option. Why haven't we thought about these other things? And to actually, it's quite satisfying as the head of OVPR to see those policies change through our involvement. Because ultimately, it's not about the production of a piece of paper as such. I couldn't care less about satisfying just the production of a piece of paper. In my mind, it's about ensuring that the program that's then agreed is a program that's going to work.
Yeah.
And that it's not going to be critiqued 2 or 3 years later because it didn't work or it didn't solve the precise problem. Or lo and behold, that agency has to come back 3 years later with a variation to that program because it didn't work as intended. Because surprise, surprise, it didn't actually fix a problem or didn't fix a problem well enough. And that's really what impact analysis is about, is about getting the products and the programs and the policies right the first time to benefit citizens rather than having to through a costly exercise, revisit and change programs over time.
Okay, I think that makes a lot of sense. And to sort of wrap up the substantive part of this discussion here, as someone who's obviously seen a lot of policies being put through, all these NPPs, new proposals, what would you like to see more of? What's the best practice that people should be aiming for to policy officers pushing things through?
Really taking a step back from what you're doing. It's not that uncommon that your manager or your manager's manager will say, right, we're gonna bring forward this, we're gonna develop this new proposal. The minister's office wants this by Monday next week. We're going to increase the size of this program. We're going to create this new program, etc. And we're really encouraging people to stop and think through themselves. Why am I writing up this program? Not because I was told to do so, but independently thinking, what is it this thing will fix? And it, you know, once you actually lock in on what the problem is, how do I confirm the evidence behind that to say that is a problem? Really, because knowing the answers to those questions helps you clarify in media releases and your downstream promotional material, you know, what the program's designed to do. But before you even get to that point, in your advice to your minister and your advice to government, you know, clarity in what you're actually trying to fix and how the options you come up with address that problem really help you to then understand who's impacted, business or individuals or the community, and you know, how are they impacted, and how do I as a policy officer get to that point where I say, this is the best option for Australia? How do I actually get to that? Not just because someone told me that's the best option we're going to run with, but how do I look at the impact analysis to really make that point? And it may be that you know, the minister and government wants to go with a different an option. Well, that's fine. But how do we perform our role as public servants to show them the ins and outs of the issue and the ins and outs of the different options to empower them to make that choice? I think they're just pausing to think those questions through. And if you ever need assistance or help with doing that, then our general number's on the screen now and the email. So contact us. We're more than happy to talk through this. We see somewhere between 1,500 and 1,800 unique different policy proposals each year. So we're whopping them out. And you wouldn't be surprised to learn that we get very good at spotting impacts and thinking about impacts. You know, you name it across the department, we've seen it. Over the versions of the impact analysis framework, there's been some version back to 1986 when it first started. So we get very, very good at breaking down a lot of pretty complex issues into the component parts and then thinking through how do you describe how different cohorts of Australians are impacted.
I think that's really good advice in the sense that I know that at least as a young person coming in, you know, entry level, grad role level sort of job, I think there is a tendency to want to sort of jump in and get started as quickly as possible. That idea that, you know, someone's giving you a task to do and you just want to jump in and send it back as quickly as possible. But that advice of just taking a step back and taking that time to really analyze, I think is quite helpful, underrated. I know that Jason actually was mentioning this in the sense that no matter what the task, he's given me a couple of tasks, and the first thing he will always say is, you know, take some time on your own, don't talk to anyone, and form your own thoughts on the matter. And that way we do get that diversity of thought, so I'm not necessarily being influenced by different people's thoughts. We're all bringing our own individual thoughts in. With that in mind, I think it's a great note to end the substantive part on. I'm thinking there might be people at this point, university students, thinking about joining the public sector, potentially the OBPR, after hearing about this. For those that are interested, what's the best way to get across info on the OBPR, gain knowledge on the political sector generally, and you know, ways to position yourself to get a job in the public sector?
Yeah, well, there's an awful lot of opportunity at the Australian Public Service through the most intakes, through the graduate mechanisms. Each department runs their own, and obviously Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet runs theirs as well. There'd be hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, of opportunities a year. And really it's about finding a department or a portfolio that best speaks to you about your interests and your attitude and what you want to do. They all do very different work through implementation focus, to slightly more implementation and policy mix through just outright policy. So they talk to different people in different ways, so really thinking about what does this department do as opposed to that department. You might think health compared to treasury, you might think you know that, but you know, I'd really challenge you. You really understand exactly what health does as opposed to treasury portfolio. What are its functions and